You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, outrage from Australia's foreign minister as Indonesia pushes ahead with the execution of two of its citizens.
We've not yet been officially informed by the Indonesian government as to the timing of the proposed executions, but given all that we've seen today via the Indonesian media, I have to assume that the Indonesian government is determined to proceed with executing these two Australian citizens.
With the outcome now all but inevitable, could this signal an irreversible turning point in diplomatic relations between the two regional powers? I'll discuss that with my studio guests, John Everard and Daniela Peled. Also ahead, surprise in Syria as a key political opposition member ducks a travel ban and makes his way to Spain.
When we got confirmation he had left Syria to head to Turkey, it hit us like a bolt of lightning. We did not expect his leaving, especially since the party's principles stipulate we must work from home and struggle for changes from inside.
Plus, as Ukraine heads into more talks with European Union leaders, could its shopping cart be looking a little empty? And empty chairs too at a literary gala as members protest a decision to give Charlie Hebdo magazine a free speech award. All that and more besides coming up here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Welcome to Midori House, 2 minutes past the hour here in London, and welcome to my guests today, former British diplomat John Everard and Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme. Now, after years of diplomatic wrangling, it seems the fate of two Australians awaiting execution in Indonesia is all but sealed. The Australian media was dominated by the topic today, with the outrage matched only by sympathy for the pair, who were due to be killed by a firing squad almost as we speak. In what may be the worst diplomatic row between Australia and Indonesia in decades, both Prime Minister Tony Abbott and Foreign Minister Julie Bishop have made their frustrations and anger at the Indonesian government very clear. John Everard, perhaps we'll start with you. Mentioning the idea of a diplomatic spat, you know, of course the fate of citizens is bound to prompt such strong emotions. Have you been surprised, though, by the sort of the willingness, the vigour with which the two sides in this have kind of gone at it in the build-up to today's events?
No, in particular, I haven't been surprised at the vigour with which the Australians have postured so shamelessly over this. It's been clear for a while that the Indonesians are going to go ahead, or were going to go ahead, with these executions. But the leaders of Australia have public opinion to think of, and so we have these great hand-wringing sessions and chest-thumping, just so that they can be seen to have opposed what the Indonesians are doing. Diplomatic row? Not really. We'll see more of this, and there may be some token gestures, but basically Australia needs Indonesia, and after a decent period, life will simply go back to normal, and I suspect that before very long, the Indonesians will find some more Australian drug smugglers to shoot.
Why do you think Indonesia is so adamant about sticking literally to their guns in this case? Clearly there's a point of principle. They have a serious problem within their own borders with the sort of the business of drugs. Is it about that? Why are they so entrenched about it, do you think?
I think there's a whole range of issues here. Firstly, there is genuine public anger and a real wish to have these guys executed. Remember that 33 Indonesians a day die from drug abuse of different kinds. It's a big domestic issue. Secondly, countries that find large neighbours trying to lean on them to change judicial decisions tend to dig their heels in and get shirty. Thirdly, there is, can we please remember, the Indonesian constitution. The president of Indonesia does not have unlimited powers of clemency. To let these guys go, he would have to have good reasons for doing so. And nobody has suggested that within the judicial system there are any such reasons. There's no doubt that they are guilty. Nobody's ever sort of cast put that in question. The only outstanding question has been this story that the judge in the case asked for $130,000 to hand out a verdict of less than 20 years, for which not a shred of evidence has been brought forward. And I have to invite listeners to think, if you were sitting on death row in Indonesia and you knew that one of the best ways you had of escaping a firing squad was to cast doubt on the judicial process that got you where you are, wouldn't you too be tempted to invent a story?
Daniel, let me ask you about this. I mean, do you go along? John suggested there that this is, you know, hand-wringing by the Australians, by the Australian sort of government and ministers, as predictable as that might have been. Do you find it as easy to be as sort of, I guess, relatively sort of sanguine about this as John is?
No, I mean, I'm afraid I can't. I think that the death penalty is an obscene act in itself. I can see plenty of reasons for clemency in this case. There's no judicial system of any note where clemency isn't an option. And these two particular chaps, everyone agrees that they've become reformed characters, deeply religious, etc., etc., etc. I mean, there is always a case for clemency. And I think really what's going on here is... however diplomatically unpleasant this may be, because, of course, it's not just Australians who are on death row. The number of people that are going to be executed today is that it plays well at home. It's a relatively new administration. And what better way of showing how tough you are by standing up to, as you said, your bigger neighbours, international pressure. You know, in most countries in the world, even liberal democracies, there is always a strong constituency that supports capital punishment. I think it comes from a quite emotional place. So this, I think, is a question of saying, right, you know, we're not listening to you. We're doing things our own way and we're tackling this in our own way.
It's interesting that you introduced that sort of international dimension to this. Tony Abbott is in France today. He's expected to discuss this crisis or these events with his French counterpart, François Hollande. France, too, has been pleading for clemency, as hard as that may be to secure for one of its citizens facing the death penalty. Do you think, John, that if you get into the situation where, you know, there are more countries involved, if there's other leadership involved, that sort of, you know, unified international front could make any difference? Or in a way, do you think that merely sort of will redouble the Indonesian conviction that what they're doing is right and shouldn't be subject to the whims of politics in other countries?
I think the latter. Firstly, I suspect the driving force behind this is simply the Indonesian judicial practice. You need a reason to show clemency, and no reason within the system has come forward. But if we look at the effect on Indonesian opinion in general about a broader front, as you put it, I think the Indonesians would simply see the world ganging up against them. The Americans, then the French, and I think we have Nigerians in there as well, who I don't know whether the Nigerian government has approached the Indonesians or not. But I suspect that any kind of joining of forces would have the opposite effect that intended.
Daniela.
Well, I mean, the Indonesian government also pleads for clemency when its citizens are...
Well, I was going to ask you about the exact point. I mean, is this a classic example then of sort of political expediency, or is it hypocrisy?
Well, I think, I mean, there's not really much point being a citizen of any country if you can't expect that country to then make representations on your behalf, even if you've done something truly awful abroad. I mean, that is something that we would just expect from our governments. Yeah, and I don't think there's any sense of irony, really, that the Indonesians would plead for this with their own citizens abroad. And, you know, they are doing the right thing. I think this shows really how unjustifiable penalties of this kind are in the abstract. And also, I think many countries in the world have moved on this idea of a punitive approach towards drug use and drug smuggling. And so it actually works. I can't believe that there would be any more of a deterrent. The death penalty is more of a deterrent than life in prison, you know, as far as drug smuggling goes. It's just a bit more dramatic, really.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is expected of government that they'll intervene for you, especially if you face the death penalty. And Indonesia, perhaps showing a certain inconsistency, as you rightly say, asks for its citizens to be reprieved, often quite forcefully. If we're talking about double standards here, also remember that the reason that these people are behind bars is because the Australian police tipped the Indonesians off. If the Indonesian police didn't want them to face a firing squad, why did they do this? They knew Indonesian law perfectly well.
Well, let me just ask you, John, in more detail about this idea of, you know, Australia seeking, you know, special treatment for its citizens, because a number of people within the Australian government have said, look, you know, the abolition of the death penalty region-wide is something that we're very committed to, we're working towards. So this isn't about, you know, special treatment. It's really only the intense media scrutiny that's led to that accusation that we're seeking special treatment. This is just part of a concerted and organised attempt, a coherent attempt to, you know, remove the death penalty in any locations where we find it, particularly in the sort of the Asia Pac region. Do you think there's any credence to that? Do you feel some
None
sympathy?
None whatever.
You don't feel any
None
sympathy?
Whatever. This is absolute balderdash. If there was any substance to that Australian position, we would be seeing all the time strident Australian protests to China, which of course executes many, many more people than Indonesia, asking China to end the death penalty. Not a squeak. Why? Because Australia is so dependent economically on China. And when did Australia last protest to the second biggest executor of people, the United States, over its death penalty? I don't buy it.
Daniel, is this the sort of unfortunate reality, as well as the terrible, you know, it's a terrible event that's occurring today, whatever your position on this is, that, you know, there's sort of hypocrisy and contradiction at every turn. John rightly points out, you know, the Chinese kill, one suspects, thousands, the exact data's not known. The US, we know it's certainly, what, 1,500 or so in over the last 30 odd years. There simply isn't that same pressure brought to bear. Does that not betray a double standard from the Australians or other nations like them?
I don't think so. I mean, I think any government has its priorities and has to order things. And of course, if one of your citizens is about to be executed in China or America or Indonesia, then that will be a priority and that is where you'll focus your efforts. Or you might be signatory to UN charters, you might be vaguely campaigning, vaguely supportive, but nothing focuses the mind like one of your own citizens facing death. Also, nothing focuses your domestic constituency as well. And I don't think that's particularly hypocrisy. I think that's just a fact of life.
Political reality, perhaps. Well, we'll have more on that story as it develops from Indonesia later on here on Monocle 24. So stay tuned for the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Now, despite a travel ban hanging over his head, Syrian opposition activist Louay Hussein has managed to flee the war-torn country and make his way to Spain just days before he was due to face the verdict of charges relating to weakening national sentiment. Hussein escaped across the Turkish border, arriving in Spain over the weekend. Daniela, Hussein's building the Syrian state party is sort of often called the tolerated opposition, though possibly not so tolerated anymore. Do you think the charges that he was facing were purely politically motivated? And if so, why grant him bail to allow him this opportunity to then leave the country? Or is it a question of having, you know, it's better if he's just not in Syria at all, according to his opponents?
Well, I mean, you know, who can see logic necessarily in the Syrian regime's actions? But I'm not sure how significant this is in any case. I was talking to some Syrian colleagues today about this, and there was a lot of eyebrow raising. I mean, this guy says he realised that there was no dialogue with the Assad regime, and he couldn't change the system within. And their response to that was, you know, not repeatable on air. I mean, on a wider sense, who is talking about the Syrian opposition anymore as a force that's going to be able to take over the country? And no one is even talking about a post-Assad era now. So his escape is not sort of major a development that it might have been under different circumstances.
John, there's suggestions that, you know, his colleagues were unaware of his plan, and you know, there's already suggestions from him that he, you know, his sort of broader political purpose is better served from abroad. But is Daniela right? Is that really a moot point? And in point of fact, the fact that there's no credible discussion even about opposition, let alone credible opposition, that's really what we should be focusing on.
Yes, I think Daniela's right. I think that's it's a sad sidelight, if you like, on the way that things have developed within Syria. As Hussein says, the Syrian regime is turning more and more into a militia. You know, it's becoming impossible to have any kind of dialogue with it. And of course, you know, internally, it's started to lose more territory. country to the Islamists is under real pressure. A few years ago, I think Hussein was a major figure and important in what was going on in Syria. I think his role has shrunk a great deal since the violence erupted. And I think Daniel is right. His disappearance from the scene probably is not the cataclysmic event that it once might have been.
Daniel, I'm intrigued to you talking to Syrian colleagues and asking what their thoughts were. Hussein suggested that, you know, from meetings in Istanbul, he can galvanize fresh support. He can arrest that sort of decline in his relevance, if you like, turn things around, maybe manage to galvanize support against, you know, the encroaching threat of Islamists that John mentions there. It's clearly a big task. It may be beyond him, but do you think he would be in a position to, you know, attract international support, given he's more, you know, sort of literally approachable in these other locations, or do you think it's just irrelevant?
Well, I mean, I think he's thinking about talking to the Syrian diaspora, attracting international support when international support is not interested, categorically not interested, and increasingly is seeing that Assad, although he does seem, this has shifted backwards and forwards over the last 4 years. Right now, he seems to be slightly on the back foot, but Assad seems to be the better option compared to the Islamists. So Istanbul, Turkey, Jordan are full of Syrian opposition figures who are still talking, theorising, involved in their own political discussions. But this is kind of internal because the international community are simply not interested. Perhaps they pay lip service to them, but no one is thinking, right, how are we going to form an interim government for the day after? There's some theorising going on, but it doesn't seem in any sort of outlook that it's a realistic option in the imminent future.
And can we bear in mind, too, that perhaps Louis Hussein is right, that he is going to be more effective outside the country, where he can probably have better access to other opposition figures. And if there is any chance of forming a kind of governed in exile, you know, maybe that's a better option than sitting inside Syria where you're not being listened to.
But is that credible, though, John? I mean, not wishing to sort of, you know, rain on his parade before it's even started. You know, you talk about trying to galvanise the diaspora, you know, a government in exile. As Daniela rightly said a moment or two ago, there doesn't seem to be any international appetite to even explore that, let alone try and facilitate it.
No, I'm not trying to talk the prospect of sudden sort of, you know, pro-democratic change in Syria up. I think that's unlikely. But if you are comparing two fairly dismal options, maybe that's the least dismal.
Indeed. The insights there of John Everard and Daniela Peled. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 and me, Tom Edwards. We'll take a short break when we come back. Ukraine was locked away in yet more meetings with European Union officials today, but will it leave empty-handed? Stay tuned.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, almost 18:19 here in London. Still with me are Daniela Peled and John Everard. Now to Ukraine. As if the dark storm clouds hanging over its war-torn east wasn't enough, Ukraine staring down the barrel at economic catastrophe as unrest and political instability continue to drain its coffers. Some hopes may be pinned on this week's talks with European Union officials. Predictions are that Ukraine will likely return to Kiev empty-handed, with the potential for EU integration a long way off and the interim step of allowing Ukrainians free entry into the EU failing to gain support. Hopes continue to rest on practical assistance for the nation in its continuing battle against Russian-backed separatists. Daniela, we saw more violence in the last few days, shelling causing the death of a government soldier. Even Ukraine's foreign minister concedes that in the light of the unrest, the EU reluctance to put more of its people in harm's way is understandable. What kind of assistance should Ukraine realistically be, I don't know, demanding, expecting, hoping for from the European Union? What should that look like now?
Well, the European Union isn't very good at sending troops, you know, boots on the ground. I think that's unrealistic to start off with. It would love, Ukraine would love economic help because it's in an awful, awful state. And part of this is due to corruption, although they're making strenuous anti-corruption measures. They would also like help with nation building, you know, as I said, anti-corruption measures, reform, legislative reform. And that's probably realistically what they're going to get rather than any big cash agreements. Or, you know, the golden thing would be easy access and travel within the EU. But there's just no way that that is going to happen right now, considering the state of turmoil that Ukraine is in. So I think they really have to lower their expectations, which must be quite a bitter pill to swallow, considering that the association agreement kind of kicked off all this trouble 18 months ago.
John, it's interesting, we talked already a lot about sort of political expediency, realpolitik, you know, the necessity of being driven by, you know, the circumstances in which you find yourselves. Do you think that for Petro Poroshenko, it's a question of trying to, you know, reassure Ukrainians that, you know, what they've been through thus far is, you know, has some greater purpose, that there is something positive to look towards? Because it does appear that, you know, the European Union is not the place to look for the kind of, you know, more significant support that Daniel is talking about there.
Well, yes, that's right. I think Poroshenko, firstly, he wants to reassure his own electorate. Of course he does. Also, I suspect that he personally has expectations of the European Union that are completely inflated. To even ask for military support from the European Union shows a lack of understanding of what this organisation is all about that is slightly dismaying. It is simply not a military bloc. The only people around Europe able to provide military intervention are NATO. And NATO's already made very clear it has no intention of doing anything, let alone putting boots on the ground. He might have got some economic support in better times. These are tough times for the European Union. He is talking to them at the same time as yet another round of crisis talks with Greece, which are likely to be expensive. And the money simply is not there. Remember, the European Union has provided 1.8 billion. It's not a great deal compared to Ukraine's needs. In terms of European taxpayers' money, it is still 1.8 billion euros. You know, it's not a casual purchase. The one thing that I think he had a moral right to expect and which the Union is dragging its heels on is the free trade agreement. It's not really clear why that isn't being moved forward. Of course, there are dark whispers and corridors about Russian pressure, perhaps. I mean, you know, it's without sitting in the meetings, it's hard to know what's going on. But I think a free trade agreement would certainly help Ukraine a great deal. Asking the European Union at this stage for the other great demand, which is visa-free access for Ukrainians to the European Union. Does Poroshenko read newspapers? I mean, absolutely no way are European politicians going to grant that.
I mean, that's interesting to reflect. If there's some, I don't know if we'd call them miscalculations on Poroshenko's side, Daniela, whether it's about access to the European Union, whether it's about access to funds, whether it's about the prospect of boots on the ground. If he has made these miscalculations, why do you think that's happened? Because, I mean, as John suggests, it doesn't seem like a radical sort of review of the news agenda would tell you that. Why has he got it wrong? Do you think it's more from just in out of hope than expectation, perhaps?
Well, perhaps. Also, as you said, Ukraine's needs are so great. I guess he thinks he might as well have a scattergun approach and ask for everything. Whatever he comes back with is going to be some comfort. But also, Ukraine is looking elsewhere for not for large funds, but also assistance. If you know something interesting that's been happening is since the beginning of the year, it's recruited an enormous number of people from Georgia to come and try and spearhead reforms and do the same kind of changes that happened in Georgia a few years ago. So the expertise is there, the experts who are going to travel there and do this or that, but the cash still remains an enormous problem. And I think the idea of the free trade agreement being stymied because of Russia is very, very plausible, because Russia Russia argues that it will be flooded with cheap goods. And I think the Europeans have shown that they are a little bit nervous of Russia still, consistently nervous.
I think that's an understatement this week. Let's move on and talk about some literary awards being boycotted over to do with Charlie Hebdo. We remember the horrific events, the massacre at their offices in Paris and at a kosher supermarket elsewhere in the city a few months ago. Public sentiment seemed firmly on the side of the magazine and its right of expression, but a decision by the international writers organisation PEN to award Charlie Hebdo with the Free Speech Award has stirred up quite a bit of controversy. On either side, we have the likes of Peter Carey and Michael Ondaatje. They say the organisation's gone beyond its role to protect writers from oppression, and that it's ignoring the French government's failure to address a moral obligation to a disempowered segment of its population. And those comments have caught the ire of, amongst others, Salman Rushdie, a former president of that organisation himself. John, no one will doubt that the Charlie Hebdo attack was an appalling crime and it was an attack on, you know, liberty and well, I guess that's the question. Was it an attack on freedom of speech, or was it a crime to look at in isolation?
It was certainly an attack on freedom of speech. I think that's quite clear. But equally, those who are boycotting the PEN meeting do have a point that traditionally, you know, PEN America has been all about supporting writers imprisoned for their beliefs, to extend that to what happened to Charlie Hebdo. Terrible though that incident was, absolutely, I agree with you. You could argue is an extension of the rules of the game by a bit. I'm a lot less comfortable with their suggestion that the French state was at fault in this. I think Ondaatje talked about its marginalisation of a significant minority. I mean, yes, okay, you know, there are inter-community problems in France as there are in many other countries.
Well, if not at fault, certainly sort of complacent was the sort of the suggestion, wasn't it, from those writers in terms of what they said?
Well, yes, that's right. Okay, you know, maybe the French government is complacent. I'm not going to sit in judgment on it either way. But whatever the French government's position, that should not have been, in my view, a factor in whether or not to go to the ceremony.
Daniel, you write about, you know, hugely, you know, divisive issues that are very contentious. Think of, you know, the Middle East, for example. Is it important to look beyond the sort of short-term motivation of people like those who attacked the Charlie Hebdo offices and say, well, look, if it's an organisation that's interested in the protection of freedom of speech, it should be encouraged. And if this was an attack on an organisation that was expressing itself, it's quite right to be recognised in this way.
Well, I think PEN wasn't giving the award to Charlie Hebdo before the attack, for saying you're very, very brave for publishing these offensive cartoons. They're giving it to you afterwards, which makes a lot more sense. And I think the people who are protesting don't really quite understand the concept of freedom of speech. And it's not a question of the issues being very important or divisive or whether you like it or not. I can think of the Sex Pistols and Never Mind the Bollocks. You know, that was a celebrated freedom of speech argument. No one was arguing that the Sex Pistols were producing a canon of incredible musical genius. It's a freedom of speech is a much purer, in a way, issue of that. And I think I don't think I would have bought Charlie Hebdo. I'm really not interested in that kind of crude satire. But that is not the point of protecting freedom of speech.
Time is short, and I do want to mention one further story before the end of the programme. The shadow of a new urban development project in Belgrade continues to grow, bringing a storm of controversy with it. Residents are taking their frustrations to a slightly unlikely hero, a large foam duck. The new so-called Dubai-style development is worth many billions of euros, but Belgrade Euros are fuming at the project. They say it'll make the rich richer at the expense of the city's ordinary resident. Well, John, what do you make of this in short?
Quack, quack.
apparently, the Serbian patka, meaning duck, is often used to describe a scam. Do you think it's people using that symbolism to say, look, you know, we don't want the rich getting richer. These are all scams. It's, you know, the people, the haves are getting more and we're not being looked after.
Yes, absolutely. And let's put this story in historical context. 4 days ago, people were bringing little rubber ducks to the demonstrations against the development. But exactly that play on words, you know, that a duck is a lie in Serbian and they wanted to give the duck back to the developers. But the duck has grown and the current version of the duck is now 2 metres tall, a serious quacker, and one that I hope will give the developers pause for thought.
Daniel, very, very briefly, are you sort of delight in seeing such sort of, you know.
Absolutely. And I think we should have more of this. It fills me with delight when the British tabloids used to dress up a man in a chicken suit and have him run after cabinet ministers who wouldn't answer awkward questions.
Perfect.
So more of this.
More ducks. That's the verdict of Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. The show is produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Mike Hewin, our studio manager, was Toby Hammond. Do stay tuned to Monocle's international playlist coming your way next. More great music from around the world. And Tom Morris has Section D for you at the top of the hour. From Midori House, it's goodbye.